Earlier on in the day of May 18, 1998, a woman named Rachel claims to have seen her neighbors, Julius Graves and Charlique Winbush, talking. Charlique was telling her fiancé, Graves, about how a man named Lee Run Chen, who worked at the Chinese restaurant up the block, Mr. Hing's, had touched her inappropriately. Graves replied that he would scare him. Later that day, Julius Graves, his fiancé's cousin, and another younger friend had a few drinks with Graves' friend Anthony Sims as they listened to music by Anthony's car. As the evening wrapped up, Graves asked Anthony to drive him down the block to Mr. Hing's. Oblivious to any issue with Chen, Anthony agreed. They went into the restaurant when it is believed that Graves shot and killed Lee Run Chen. In shock, Anthony fled alone, while Graves and the two younger guys returned to Graves' apartment, wiped the gun clean, figured out where to stash it, and began to conjure up a story to deflect blame from Graves and onto Anthony Sims. With Graves and a number of his friends and family supporting this phony narrative, investigators set their sights on Anthony. Only one witness came forward independently who was neither coerced nor friends and family of Julius Graves. Graves' neighbor, Rachel, who was on the phone outside of Mr. Hing's during the shooting and saw Graves running from the restaurant with a sawed-off shotgun in his hand. Yet, her statement was ignored by investigators and hidden from the defense. And as a result, Anthony Sims continues to serve 25 years to life. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me. And today, if you hear my voice, it sounds sort of down. I mean, this is one of the most troubling wrongful conviction cases that I've ever seen in 28 years of doing this work, which is almost as long as Anthony Sims has been locked up for a crime he obviously didn't commit. First of all, I want to introduce the two attorneys who are so devoted to this case and to this man. Jonathan Hiles and Thomas Hoffman, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing this, Jason.
And now, of course, saving the best for last, and I'm just so sorry that you're here under these circumstances, but I'm honestly honored that you're here with us today on the podcast. So, Anthony Sims, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you.
And Anthony, of course, is now a 45-year-old man, 24 years into a 25-to-life sentence for a murder he didn't commit. Now, this began back in 1998, but I want to go back even further than that. Anthony, where did you grow up and what was your childhood like? Was it a happy childhood?
Yes, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and with my mother, father, and my two older brothers. And we had was a very happy, loving family. We would do a lot of fun activities together, go on vacations. I remember every Sunday was family day. Whatever we needed to do, we had to do together as a family.
And leading up to when this awful crime occurred, you had kids, a fiance at that time. What was life like for you?
I lived what I thought was a normal life. I worked for Bell Atlantic Telephone Company, and I was a field technician. I installed phone lines and provided dial tone to customers. I lived with my fiance, Keisha, and my two sons at the time. And we would do a lot of family things together. As I told you, I'm very family oriented. So we would go out to movies, parks, breakfast, rides, everything. We would just do as much as we can possibly.
So this brings us to May 18th, 1998, when you, Anthony, witnessed a terrible crime. There was a Chinese restaurant, Mr. Hing's, which was down the block from where your former friend Julius Graves lived. And around 10 o'clock that night, a man named Lee Run Chen, who worked at Mr. Hing's, was shot and killed. But earlier that day, before any of that happened, you thought you were just going to swing by Graves' apartment to show him this new car you bought for your fiance, Keisha.
So this day, I decided to buy her a car. And Julius Graves was, at that time, my best friend. And of course, because I bought the car, I was happy, I wanted to show him the car that I bought my wife to surprise her. So I drove to his house at that time. So during that time, he asked me to drive him to the liquor store. I drove him to the liquor store. I went to the regular store and bought some beer. We was talking. I was letting the music play from my car radio. And then his two friends came over. His fiance's cousin, Derek, and then later on, his friend, Louie. And they was listening to music with us. And I want to say like around 10 o'clock, it was getting late. I wanted to go home, show my wife the car, and I wanted to be home with my sons. So during that time, Julius asked me to drive him to the Chinese restaurant. So I thought this was a weird request because he lived down the block around the corner from the restaurant, and I thought he could have just walked to the restaurant. So I said, all right, listen, I was drinking a couple of beers. Let me go to the store to buy some breath mints because I don't like driving around like that. I remember right before I decided to go to the store to get the breath mints or whatever, I remember Julius saying, listen, and I'm going to the house. I'm going to go check with Chalik, which was his girlfriend at the time, to see if she wanted anything from the store as well. So I said, all right. So I can only assume that's the time that he got the weapon. And when I got back to my car, Julius was sitting in my passenger seat, and his two little friends were sitting in the back. They know that I didn't expect them to be in the car because they looked at me with this look like, all right, well, we're just going to go to this restaurant with you. So I didn't think nothing of it. I got in the car and I drove to the Chinese restaurant. When I got out the car, I looked back and I noticed they were still sitting in the car. So I was like, all right, come on, because I'm not driving you home from here. I'm going straight home because it was getting late. So I decided to proceed to the Chinese restaurant. When I got inside of the restaurant, I started looking around for the menus and stuff to see what I was going to purchase for my wife. The next thing I know, I saw Julius come in the store with like a weird expression on his face. And almost immediately, he reached in his pants and pulled out a sawed-off shotgun. And I remember thinking, like, what the hell is going on? And where did he even get that gun from? I asked him, I said, what the hell are you doing? Are you crazy? Julius Sexy said, no. Approached the counter, pointed the gun at one of the workers, and pulled the trigger. And I couldn't believe it. I felt the blood rush from my body. I was, like, shocked. And all I remember at that time, just running out the store, getting in my car. Julius jumped in there too, and I said, oh, get out. I kicked everybody. I said, everybody get out of my car. And I drove home and told Keisha what happened. That was the worst night of my life.
Yeah, it would be the worst night of almost anyone's life to witness something like that.
That night, when I went home, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I got home, I got on the phone, and I called them. And I said, what the hell is wrong with you? I probably cursed him. I said some other things to him. Basically, I want to know, why did he put me in that situation? Why did he allow me to walk into that? Why didn't he tell me what was going on? Maybe he thought I would talk him out of it. I don't know. But he just kept apologizing. And that's when he told me that, you know, the person that he shot died. I couldn't believe it. And I said, Julius, don't ever call me again. I don't want to hear from you no more. I just wanted to try to separate myself from him.
So it turns out that Julius Graves had a motive, and that is that Graves was upset that Mr. Chen, who worked at the Chinese restaurant, had reportedly touched the hand of Graves' fiancée, Charlique, earlier in the day of the murder, that he had touched her hand inappropriately. She was upset about this. She told Graves, and Graves said that he would go to the restaurant and scare the victim. We know he did a lot more than that, but that appears to have been the motive that we didn't find out until many years later. Now, what was known at the time is that after the murder, after Anthony got Graves and his two friends, Derek Dollop and Louis Colon, to leave the car, it is undisputed that Graves took the shotgun used in the murder, went back to the apartment where he was staying, feverishly wiped off the shotgun to get his fingerprints off of it, and then gave the gun to his friend, Louis Colon, to hide from police. And Louis, by the way, was only 14 years old at the time. Graves's excuse for doing this is that he wasn't thinking. That was his only justification for the fact that he took the murder weapon, wiped it of his fingerprints, and tried to hide it from police. Now, furthermore, this murder weapon, the sawed-off shotgun, had previously been kept in a lockbox in the apartment where Graves was staying. And Graves and his friend, Derek Dollop, who was also his fiance's cousin, admitted even that they knew the shotgun was kept there and had seen it there before. So all the evidence suggested that the shotgun belonged to Graves, and it is undisputed he had handled it right after the murder occurred.
Right. And the physical evidence from the scene later proved that this sawed-off shotgun from Graves' apartment was used in the murder. So this is where we start seeing a narrative being formed from the Graves camp to try to deflect responsibility for this murder away from Graves and toward Anthony. And initially, it will seem like a lot of witnesses came forward to support what was really just coming straight from Graves' imagination, and what later became the prosecution's narrative. But it will become clear as we move along here that none of these witnesses were to be believed. They shouldn't have been believed for two reasons. One, it's discovered later that these eyewitness accounts are initially riddled with glaring inconsistencies and contradictions that were then changed to fit a cohesive narrative in time for trial, which is just not typical when a group of people are telling the truth, obviously, right? And two, most of the witnesses are friends and family of Graves. There are only two witnesses, two, who are not Graves' friends or family, one of whom was coerced by police into an ambiguous statement that nonetheless helped the prosecution's case at the time of trial, and the other is the only independent witness who bravely came forward to tell the truth about Graves' motive and having seen him running from the restaurant with a gun. However, none of this info about these two witnesses was known to the defense at trial, but we'll get to that later. Now, right now, let's focus on the dubious narrative coming from the Graves camp. So, the day after the murder, Charlique's brother, William Robertson, told police a secondhand story from Charlique that Charlique had said that Anthony had come by earlier, the day of the murder, and taken the shotgun out of the apartment. Then comes the narrative from Graves about the night of the murder. Okay, ready? So, according to Graves, Anthony dropped by the apartment around 6 p.m. and they had a few drinks. Anthony allegedly showed Graves a shotgun that he had in his trunk, a shotgun that Graves should have recognized as the one from his apartment, as Jonathan just said that Graves had admitted. Now, at some point, Anthony and Graves are joined by Charlique's cousin, Derek Dallop, and another younger friend, Luis Colon. According to Graves, Anthony had a previous altercation with the victim, Li Run Chen, who worked at the Chinese restaurant down the block, Mr. Hing's. The reason behind this disagreement and the timing changed between initial interviews and trial. In this farcical version of events, Anthony allegedly had refused to pay for something at Mr. Hing's because it was either something he hadn't ordered or some chicken was undercooked or it didn't look right. You know, lying is tricky that way, right? It gets hard to keep track of your own bullshit. Anyway, at the time of this alleged problem and refusal of payment, Li Run Chen allegedly pulled a gun on Anthony, to which Anthony allegedly responded that he would get Chen for this. So this patently ridiculous and poorly written story is what established Anthony's alleged motive to murder Li Run Chen. According to Graves, that night, in the lead up to the murder, Anthony brought up this 2 to 3 week old and then later 4 to 5 month old beef several times and was getting heated up about it before they headed to Mr. Hing's, where Anthony was the one who allegedly shot Li Run Chen, not Graves, whose fiance had complained to him about Chen's inappropriate touching earlier that day. So this just super believable narrative is what became the prosecution's theory.
I don't even know what to say at this point, but it just feels liberating to hear you retell that story because it sounded crazy to me. And from you saying how crazy it sounds to you, that means a lot because I've always believed down the line that the truth was going to come out and the truth was going to set me free. I didn't know that I would be in prison 23 years before this truth came out.
And it's going to be out there now, finally, for everyone to hear to shine a much needed light on this terrible and tragic injustice. There are a lot of good people working on your behalf right now, not least of which, of course, are your lawyers. And Jonathan, there's even more to know about Graves' ridiculous narrative.
Yeah, I think the chronology of how the investigation unfolded, which, Jason, you've sort of given that it was Graves trying to divert attention from himself, he, his friends, and his family. And that's why the murder got pinned on Anthony, because the case against Graves was so overwhelming that there had to be a scapegoat. And the story against Anthony was not only ridiculous, but as you alluded to, it was so inconsistent. Graves first actually told police Anthony and Graves' other two friends had gone to the Chinese restaurant earlier on that evening and then come back, and Anthony was heated about an argument with the victim. But Graves' two friends never said they went to the Chinese restaurant. It was just made up. So Graves had to change his story and say that he had witnessed an argument between Anthony and the victim months earlier over a food order, and that Anthony was still fuming about this months later on the night of the murder. Again, Graves' friends, right, who were trying to back him up, they never said that Anthony had any beef with the victim or was fuming about it in the car that evening. So the story never really made sense. But what was important to police and prosecutors, unfortunately, was clearing the case. And once they had Graves and his two friends who were willing to point the finger at Anthony as a scapegoat, the train had left the station.
Okay, so they've got their sights set on you, Anthony. And initially, they show up at your job, but you were out that day. This tipped you off, though, that they were at least looking to talk to you, and eventually you went in voluntarily. I mean, you were an innocent man, so did you think, well, I'll just go in there, clear this up, and head on home?
I did. And a big key that was being left out was there was a camera inside of that restaurant. So I thought, regardless, that somebody would, at one point in time, review the tape. And then I had nothing to worry about. The tape would clear everything up for me. So, yes, I drove myself to the precinct, and that's where I've been ever since, locked away.
You never walked out of there again?
Never walked out, no.
What happened with the videotape from the Chinese restaurant?
They said that the tape wasn't recorded.
Do you believe that?
To be honest, I don't know what to believe anymore. I used to have a lot of faith in the judicial system, but from being incarcerated myself and listening to some of the other horror stories from people in here with me, I don't know what to believe now.
They had their man, and any other evidence that existed then or emerged later that suggested Anthony was innocent or that Graves was guilty was just an inconvenience to the prosecution's case, and so it was not disclosed to the defense.
And of course, listeners of this show will know that when the authorities withhold exculpatory evidence, it's called a Brady violation. And Brady violations are illegal, but as our listeners also know, Brady violations rarely seem to bring any actual ramifications for the people who commit them. So it just keeps fucking happening in case after case. And in this case, I believe the worst Brady violation, the worst one among so many, is the sole independent witness who came forward in this case that I alluded to earlier, whose statement was hidden from the defense. We'll refer to her only as Rachel.
So Rachel was right outside the Chinese restaurant where the murder occurred, talking on a payphone. This was an undisputed fact, and police spoke to her. And initially, she said that she had heard the shot and seen people running from the Chinese restaurant, but she didn't have her contacts in, and so she couldn't identify who those people were. That was what she said. Now, this was not a neighborhood where it was easy to report to police who you had seen involved in a murder, much less if that person was your neighbor. And actually, Rachel, who was 17 at the time, she was neighbors with Julius Graves. Now, a couple of weeks went by, and Rachel had kept this information to herself, but her conscience was gnawing away at her. She learned that Anthony had been wrongfully arrested for the crime, and she actually received a call from Anthony's wife at the time, Keisha, who said to Rachel, "I hear you were present at the scene and that you may have seen something. Please just talk to police. Tell them what you saw, whatever you saw. Please just tell them the truth." Now, at around the same time, Rachel actually had an exchange with Graves and his fiance outside of their brownstone. During that exchange, there was an argument, and Rachel said, "You know, I know what you did. I saw what you did." And what had she seen? In truth, she had seen Julius Graves, her neighbor, running from the Chinese restaurant with a shotgun right after the shot was fired. So she knew that he had run off with a weapon and was likely the killer. And she said, "I know what you did, and you're trying to put it on somebody else." And Graves said, "You talk too much, and if you keep talking, I'm going to shut you up." And Rachel was terrified, but she was also angry. at what was happening and at the injustice and also at the way Graves was talking to her. And so she called police, spoke to a detective, and she said, "I saw Julius Graves running from the Chinese restaurant with a big, long gun. I know it was him. He's my neighbor." And the detective said, "We already have another guy. It was the taller guy. Anthony is 6'3", Graves is 5'9". Rachel said, "No, I know they look completely different. I know that it was Graves who was running with the shotgun." And the detective basically said, "Well, thank you for your time," and hung up the phone. They had already arrested Anthony and decided he was the guy they were going to pin the murder on.
Shalik had anticipated that Rachel could go to the police. So Shalik reports that Rachel said that Graves had committed the murder, and she spun that as harassment. That was a written report. They had that report. But if I can complete that, incredibly, even though Rachel lived next door to Shalik, they did not question Rachel at all about that police report. They didn't go up, knock on the door, and say, "Is this true?"
They didn't have to go across the country to interview somebody or across the state, right? They'd go across the street. Across the street. Somebody who actually had begged to be interviewed, right? Who, even though she had been threatened by a really dangerous guy, was like, "No, I'm going to do the right thing." As someone we could be proud of, you know, that comes forward in a situation like this. But instead, she just got shut down by those who are supposed to protect us, which left Graves out on the streets to potentially commit more violent crimes while Anthony was stripped of his freedom and civil rights. So back to this investigation, if you want to call it that, the grandmother of Graves's children, you know, Charlique's mom, signs on to parrot some of the narrative. This is Dorothy Boulding, whose story changed from her initial interview when she didn't mention Anthony Graves or even having been at Mr. Hing's at all. This interview, critical information here, was hidden from the defense. And by the time the grand jury and the trial roll around, she's changed her story, now claiming to be able to implicate Anthony in the murder. But still, the investigators needed to get someone outside of Graves's inner circle in order to strengthen the case. And as I alluded to earlier, this is the only other witness besides Rachel who was not directly related to Graves. She was a single mom who certainly appears to have been coerced into giving an ambiguous statement that helped the prosecution's case at trial, and we'll refer to this witness as Shalima.
Now, Shalima, as we have since learned, she initially told police that she, when visiting her friend's apartment across the street from the murder, had heard this loud bang, had looked out the window across the street from a second floor on a dark night, and had seen a couple of men ran out of the Chinese restaurant, but she couldn't describe them at all. She'd seen that one of them appeared to be holding a long gun, but she couldn't make any sort of description because it was dark and it was a very fleeting observation. And they said, "Well, let's take you in and see if we can refresh your memory." They took her in, they separated her from her young child, and they interrogated her for hours and intimidated her and wouldn't tell her where her child was, which she kept asking. And then eventually they emerged with a report saying that she identified the taller man as being the one holding the gun, which was something that was clearly fed to her because she told police that she couldn't describe the men she had seen, including the person who was running with the gun. We first learned that in the past year. Shalima said, "I don't know how I could have testified that I saw the taller man running with the shotgun. I couldn't have made a description. And that's what I told detectives." And their response was to take me in for basically a full day of interrogation, separated from my child, until they had pressured her to give them what they wanted. And so the prosecution really leaned on her with this made-up story that they sort of force-fed her because she was the only witness who wasn't totally biased in favor of Graves.
Right. So now they finally had someone, as shaky as this ID was, to corroborate what the Graves camp was saying. So July 2nd, 1998, they charged you, Anthony, with two counts of murder in the second degree, intentional and depraved indifference, and one count of criminal possession of a weapon in the fourth degree, a weapon that you had never even held in your hand. And before trial even began in April 1999, Graves attempted to disappear.
Graves didn't want to testify. He wanted to get himself off of the hook, but even he perhaps had some pangs of conscience about falsely implicating someone who had formerly been his friend. And so he went underground before the trial started, and he was on probation at the time, actually on a weapons possession charge. And he hadn't been reporting to his probation officer for 3 years. And so the district attorney's office actually initiated proceedings to revoke Graves's probation so that he would be remanded to prison, potentially. And in the meantime, Graves went into hiding because he didn't want to participate in the prosecution's case, which was, as you said, Jason, a made-up case that was based on Graves' own lies.
This one's really mystifying. I mean, you have a guy who has a propensity to violence, who knows his way around with weapons, who was in possession of the gun, who had a previous weapons violation. And it's like, yeah, no, we're just going to ignore that.
Julius was asked directly, have you reported to your probation officer often and regularly? He answered yes, when he hadn't reported for 3 years. And that lie was not corrected. And clearly the credibility of Graves was critical. We did not know that he had not reported till last year.
So at trial, the state presented Shalima along with Graves's cadre of liars, right? Graves himself, of course, and his fiance's cousin, Derek Dallop, his friend, Luis Colon, and the grandmother of Graves's two children, Dorothy Boulding. Now, Boulding's story changed twice. In her initial interview, she didn't mention seeing Graves, Anthony, or even having been at Mr. Hing's. And then at the grand jury, she testified that while drinking outside of Mr. Hing's, she saw Anthony enter with a long gun and heard a shot fired before Graves entered the restaurant. Then at trial, I don't know, maybe she had some pangs of conscience. Either way, though, she testified that she saw Anthony go in, followed by Graves, then heard a gunshot, but never saw a gun.
Miss Boulding, her initial report would have really discredited her as a prosecution witness, was not disclosed. Also not disclosed her bias given her relation to Julius Graves.
Okay, so now there's Shalima. She also testified against you, Anthony. She said that on the night of the shooting, she was visiting a friend who lived on the second floor in an apartment across the street from Mr. Hing's. She said that she heard a gunshot and looked out the window to see two black men running from the restaurant. And that, quote, the taller guy had a gun.
This was helpful for the prosecution because Anthony was taller than Graves. Now, Shalima did not identify Anthony. The prosecutor tried to get her to identify Anthony. Look around the courtroom. Is the person you saw running with the gun here? She said, I don't know. I can't say. And also, she testified that of the two men she saw running, it was the person who was running second, who was behind, who was running with the shotgun. Graves testified that he was running second, that he was behind Anthony. So actually, her testimony was very ambiguous, but it was really the only thing the prosecution had that came outside of Graves' inner circle. And as a result, the failure to disclose what Shalima had told detectives from the beginning, that she couldn't describe anything, was a very damaging Brady violation for Anthony's defense.
Was there any real defense mounted in your case, Anthony?
No. We didn't even call any witnesses on my behalf, although I asked my lawyer, can I testify? And he said no. What rightful person would just sit there and listen to people say certain things about him and not defend themselves? Like, he was really confident that there was no need for that because the case was a weak case and they'll eventually be able to say, you know, Julia did it, whatever, and that was that. So I didn't really have a defense.
So after hearing from Graves' network of liars and Shalima's ambiguous testimony, and then importantly, the absence of Rachel, did you still hold out any hope at all that you'd be vindicated?
I did, only because it was a time during the deliberations where the jury came back into the courtroom and they passed a note that said they were deadlocked. And the judge said, well, listen, I'm going to give you a brief Allen charge. it was almost like a kangaroo court, because he was basically saying, well, I don't know what the problem is. It's not like he's facing a death penalty. Go give me a verdict. And they needed some readbacks, some questions and stuff. And I looked at my lawyer at that point, and I was mad because I said, well, maybe if I testified, maybe it would have been different. Maybe we wouldn't be at this point. But to answer your question, I was still hopeful, although hope was slipping away at that point.
But they came back and found you guilty. What was that moment? Was if you can just take us inside that courtroom and inside your mind and your soul at that moment.
I was shocked, confused. I was hurt, devastated, nauseous. I mean, I was angry. I remember trying to stand up, but I didn't have any feeling in my legs. I just felt weak. Ironically, what was going through my mind at that point was my sons, because they were so young. And every night, I would tell them crazy bedtime stories, either ones that I read from a book or I used to make up some stories. And they looked forward to going to sleep just so that I could come in the room and tell them stories. And I said to myself, I'm not going to be able to do that for a while. As you can imagine, for the first couple of years, I was very bitter. I was mad. I was angry. And I was almost like a walking zombie, so to speak. I mean, I was always trying to do programs and stuff and try to help myself and help other people as well. But inside, I was really messed up. And I remember going on a visit one day, and my son, little Anthony Jr., which I love to die, I love both my sons, he was crying. He just broke out one day crying on a visit, and he said, Daddy, don't worry. I'm gonna get Julius for doing this to you. Because he had known at that point Julius as his uncle, because we were so close. And I looked at him, and I said, no, Anthony, don't ever say that again. I said, don't ever say that, no. And I was basically letting him know that the law will eventually prevail and things will work itself out. And in the same tears, he looked at me and he says, well, then, Daddy, you got to promise me that you would never do anything to him either. And I said, I won't, and I promise you that. And it was that point that I forgave Julius. And I continued to live my life as a life giver, but also trying to help any and everybody out, because in a sense, helping me as well. But that was my turning point. That's when I forgave him for doing what he did.
Wow. Sounds like you did a hell of a job, even in the brief time you had with your sons, raising them and teaching them right.
Unfortunately, prison has a way to divide families, as you can only imagine. So my son's mother, which is my wife at the time, her name is also Keisha. This prison bit became too much for us, and it felt like I was holding her back from living her life. So we both came to the agreement that we should just divorce and separate so that she can live her life, so to speak. And God always has a way of making things happen. But my wife today, which is also named Keisha, is my junior high school girlfriend. She was my cheerleader when I was the captain of the basketball team. So Keisha started to write me. And one thing turned into another. All of the old feelings came back. And we decided to try one more time and get married. And that was probably the best decision of my life.
My name is Keisha Sims, and I am Anthony Sims' wife. And it's the best decision that we've ever made, that I've ever made. Anthony and I were, junior high school sweethearts. You know, people in this situation always think that the people in prison, they should be grateful that someone makes this type of commitment to them under these circumstances. But for me, Anthony has brought just so much to my life. He has enriched my life so much. I've grown so much as a person because of him. This situation in particular has made me stronger. And so I'm just grateful that he chose me to go on this journey with him and to fight for his innocence.
One day I was reading the newspaper from a friend of mine named Kevin Jenkins. He asked me to read this article because the article involved the person that we both knew from Green Haven, Emmanuel Cooper. Kevin suggested that I try to get in touch with Tom Hoffman, the lawyer that got this guy out. So I talked to my wife, and she said that night it was hard for her to sleep because she worked around a lot of lawyers. She knew that she only had one shot at this. And she was making little bullet points. She was rehearsing what she was saying because she knew that it was really important to obtain Thomas Hoffman. She said the first thing Tom wanted to know was he innocent? Because he would not represent anybody who was not innocent. And Keisha told him, yes, he is, but I'm going to send you some information so that you can see it for yourself.
At that point, I had all of Anthony's legal work because his son had kept all of his documentation. And he said, well, send me everything that you have. So I'm working from home. All I have is an Adobe Scan app on my phone, which can only scan one page at a time. One of Anthony's transcripts is 400 and some odd pages. That's just only one transcript. And I did that for days, you know, trying to get all the information to him. And he saw all of the discrepancies, you know, and all the violations and things that we had always seen. Tom knew that Anthony was innocent, and it was just astounding evidence to support that.
And the rest is history. I got Tom Hoffman and Jonathan House doing my case pro bono, and I've never had lawyers work as hard as they work, ever.
It's an amazing story. I mean, a tale of two Keishas, and which eventually resulted in these two attorneys, which of course brings us to the post-conviction litigation. And it looks like before you both got involved, there were some filings surrounding an inappropriate remark by the prosecutor, ineffective assistance claims, trial court errors, discriminatory jury challenges, all of which were serious points, but ultimately failed. There was some new evidence, a recantation of trial testimony from Graves. We know he was feeling remorseful for throwing Anthony under the bus, but he didn't want to come clean. So this affidavit really is reflective of that, meaning he doesn't tell the whole truth. He basically says that Anthony went inside Mr. Hings and he, Julius Graves, did not. He continued that he didn't see who shot Chen and was coerced to testify that he had seen Anthony do it. So it takes the onus off of Anthony, but it's definitely not the exonerating evidence that one would hope for, as were the other filings in this case.
Everything that sort of happened in those initial post-trial proceedings was sort of skirmishes around secondary issues, which unfortunately is often the best you can do for a convicted person until you get a Tom Hoffman to fully reinvestigate the case like a detective.
Right. Without Tom, we wouldn't know the context around Shalima's testimony, which is what passed for a corroborating witness for Graves and his whole network of liars. I mean, it wasn't corroborating testimony at all, but misleading or even pointing to Graves' guilt. And then the major Brady violation in hiding Rachel for all of these years. Remember, she witnessed Charlique and Graves talking about the inappropriate touching, which established the motive. She saw Graves running from Mr. Hings with a gun. Then, when she confronted Charlique and Graves, she was threatened. "You talk too much. You keep talking. I'm going to shut you up," was the quote. Not to even mention all of the previously unknown or ignored holes and shifts in Graves' narrative. And finally, we haven't even talked about this yet, but there was a cook at Mr. Hing's who had a view of the shooter and described his complexion as, quote, "not black." This is consistent with Graves' light brown skin, while Anthony, importantly, has a dark complexion. So, Tom, what is being done with all of the exculpatory evidence that you've compiled?
The 440 was initially filed in December, and we attached Rachel's affidavit, Shalima's statement. Both of those statements were recorded from beginning to end, hello to goodbye. We also found this documentation that Graves had lied about reporting to his probation officer often and regularly. We also found additional Brady violations. And as the case was proceeding, we then get even more documents from Foyle, including that Graves, on the day of his testimony, received money, received housing together with his girlfriend's brother, and the brother's girlfriend. And then he eventually gets $25,000 in benefits. All this comes out. So we then amend our petition. We also found out that Cologne had told one of his friends that it was his friend who committed the shooting. Well, his friend was Julius Graves. That was only recently ascertained. as with others. And I should say, look, the current 440 ADAs, in their response, they did not address any of our allegations. Did Julius Graves lie or did he not lie? Not addressed. They said you could have a hearing. Well, the hearing's going to take quite a while, and Anthony should be home now. His children are now 27 and 28. His father recently suffered a stroke. His 88-year-old grandmother wants to see her grandson before she dies. The evidence is overwhelming. Anthony should not have to wait any longer. The resistance on undoing a wrongful conviction is huge.
Yeah, it is, even under normal circumstances. But here in Brooklyn, there's been an even more obstinate than usual obstacle in this case. Anthony brought his case to the Brooklyn Conviction Review Unit in 2017, and one would think that the good folks there would take one look at Graves' bullshit and do something about it. But the man tasked with running the CRU in Brooklyn since 2014 was Mark Hale, who just so happens to be the man who prosecuted Anthony's case. But, and this is a big but, Mark Hale just retired at the beginning of July 2021. So while this is good news for Anthony, there are still plenty of ways that this might not work out.
So while we know that our case is overwhelming, there is no assurance that we're going to prevail. And that's why we need all of the help that we can.
We appreciate all of the listeners to the podcast. And of course, Jason, all of your advocacy, what you're doing, and just giving us a platform. We have a website, freeanthonysims.com, and you can sign your name to the petition, which calls on Brooklyn District Attorney Eric Gonzalez to join our motion to vacate Anthony's wrongful conviction and to let him go home to his family where he belongs. There's also a link where you can email the district attorney's office. So please visit freeanthonysims.com, and we greatly appreciate all of your help.
And I'm going to be signing and joining. And, you know, I do believe in Eric Gonzalez. Eric, if you're listening right now, we're counting on you. That's all I can say.
We believe that DA Gonzalez, once he understands this case, he's going to do the right thing.
Amen to that. And I'll have the website linked in our episode bio. Okay, so now we come to the part of the show called Closing Arguments, where I offer my sincere thanks to you guys, Jonathan Hiles and Thomas Hoffman, for your passionate devotion to this case and just for being good humans. And of course, you know, Anthony, you're a hero to me and so many other people, just for your spirit, courage, and your grace. You know, it's really an honor to have you here today. And so here's how this works. I'm going to turn my microphone off, kick back in my chair, close my eyes, and each of you guys get the opportunity to share any final parting thoughts you have. We call it closing arguments. We'll start with Jonathan Hiles, then you could pass the mic to Thomas Hoffman, and then we'll save the best for last. And Anthony, you'll be, with all due respect to you guys, Anthony's going to be batting cleanup, so to speak. So without further ado, Jonathan Hiles, closing arguments.
Thank you, Jason. I think it's important to look at the broader picture and how this injustice occurred, and it's because the system did not value the life of Anthony Sims, and it also did not value the life of Lee-Run Chun. And what we're fighting to do is to make sure that justice is served for Anthony and also for the victim, for the truth to emerge, and every ounce of help we can get to ensure that happens is deeply appreciated, because the truth has been clear from the start, and that truth is that Julius Graves was the perpetrator of this awful crime, not Anthony Sims, and it's time for Anthony to go home and to be reunited with his family so that he can be with them and serve the community to which he has so much to contribute. So thank you again, Jason.
Thank you again for doing this. I believe you have had 145 podcasts of people who were wrongfully convicted. I have listened to many. While the facts vary, the stories are all the same. A horrific crime is committed, drawing wide media and public attention. Perpetrators need to be taken off the street and held to account. However, the concern of the police and the prosecutors is not to find the actual perpetrator, but to give the public the perception that the case was solved. It did not matter whether the right person was brought to justice, as long as a conviction was secured and the public fear allayed. As Jonathan said, neither the victim nor the defendant's life is valued as long as the case is won. So too, the public is not valued, as the police did not care whether the actual perpetrator remained loose and posed a danger to the public. Also common, in order to win these cases, evidence pointing away from the defendant's culpability is ignored and not investigated, as such investigation could potentially exculpate the accused. And of course, Rachel is an example of that in this case. Favorable evidence pointing away from defendant's guilt is disregarded, and in contravention of the prosecutor's constitutional duty, is hidden from the defendant. Meanwhile, husbands, wives, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, and sons, and daughters are destroyed, all in the interest of winning at all costs. People ask me, why do I do this? I am a Holocaust survivor. I was born in 1944. Basically, my family, extensive family, was wiped out. And that Holocaust was caused by people remaining silent. And that is why I call on our audience not to be silent. Go to their website to undo this horrific injustice.
Anthony?
I want to say thank you, Tom, Jonathan, Jason, and Connor. I really thank y'all for this. This has probably been one of the highlights of many years. And now that I know that Gonzalez is going to be looking at this, I want to talk directly to you, Mr. Gonzalez. And I want to ask that you please review this evidence and don't just discard my case like the rest of them. View it with an open mind, understand what happened. And although I'll never be able to get back all the years that I've been in here unjust, you can make this right by doing the right thing. Allow me to be the father again out there in society that I know I need to be with my sons. Allow me to spend some time with my mother and father who got old. You know, my father had a stroke. My mother's walking around with a cane as a 9/11 victim. My grandmother, who's 86 years old, who lives for me. My wife, my family, just in general. Allow me to get some of my life back. Do the right thing.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Please support your local innocence projects and go to the link in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Warnes. The music on the show, as always, is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.